Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
The Stout Waddy Game. Shall I go first? I'm going to go first.
Go on, go first. You're obviously, you've made your mind up.
I've made my mind up.
Standing confident.
I've got a category. The category is Psychobilly.
Psychobilly. Oh, that's good.
Okay, so that's rockabilly for people who went to university. Okay,
that's good. Right. Yes, psychobilly. Yeah.
Rockabilly for people who watch late night terrible films and so forth. Okay, these are five groups. Okay, one of them is a completely fictitious construct.
All right.
But the other four are real. Okay. Are you ready? Swamp Trash, The Termites, Elvis Hitler, The Deadly Wasps, and Southern Culture on the Skids. Those five again. Swamp Trash, The Termites, Elvis Hitler, The Deadly Wasps, and Southern Culture on the Skids. Which of those is a product of my fecund imagination?
Wow. Swamp Trash, I think, sounds real. A lot of psychobilly was about, it was about that kind of unspeakable landscapes. It's a sort of science fiction kind of rockabilly, wasn't it? So Swamp Trash, I think, is real. Termites, possibly. Elvis Hitler, I'm sure I've heard of, actually. Deadly Wasps is a possibility, isn't it? And what was the last one? Southern culture
on the Skids.
That's so weird. I think it's actually real. Dave, I'm going to say it's the termites. I don't know why I'm saying that you've made
it. I win!
Okay, go on.
The termites are real. I'd made up the deadly wasps, which you should
have got,
because it's so much inspired by the termites, isn't it?
It is. But it's a Beatles relationship. Yeah.
Swamp Trash, The Termites, Elvis Hitler, and Southern Culture and the skids were all real. Okay, over to you.
You win. All right. Okay. Right. Slight deviation here. Tons of musicians have made the often unwise choice to appear in movies. So here are six brief cameo film appearances by rock stars. Five of them actually happened. One is a figment of my imagination.
All right?
Okay. Here they are, the six. Dave Grohl appeared as Beelzebos, a giant Satan-esque monster in Tenacious D, The Pick of Destiny. One. Jack White appeared as Elvis Presley in the music biopic parody Walk Hard. Okay. Björk had a cameo as the fortune teller Tova in the Swedish murder mystery The Orchid Gardener. All right. Alanis Morissette appeared in a religious comedy called Dogma, playing the part of God. And David Crosby turned up as a pirate in Steven Spielberg's Hook.
Oh.
So shall I give you those again very briefly? That's Dave Grohl as Beelzebos. Jack White turning up as Elvis Presley, Björk as the fortune teller Tova, Alanis Morissette in a religious comedy playing the part of God, and David Crosby as a pirate.
Well, it's a really good list because they sound exactly like the kind of ludicrous things people do. Terrible parts in what sound like genuinely terrible films, you know, where everybody...
That's right, because you would have heard of those films, probably.
Yeah, because everybody...
You might have seen those films if they'd been any good, but you kind of...
It's all wacky and really...
It is.
But I'm going to say that the one you've made up is David Crosby.
Oh, my Lord! Are you being generous there or not? That's very sweet of you. You really did? Okay. That's true.
He really does appear in Hook.
He does appear in Hook. And that's when Phil Collins is in it too, actually. And someone else plays a pirate. I can't remember who, but Phil Collins is in Hook too. The one I made up was Björk.
Oh, wow.
I thought that's the kind of thing she would do as a kind of teenage, starting out, trying to get the career going, doing a bit of teenage acting or whatever.
She was a child star, wasn't she, Björk?
She was a child star, and she was in a Lars von Trier movie. about whatever it was, 10 or 12 years ago. Very controversial. She fell out with him dramatically.
Sounds enormous fun.
But the sun, yeah. We're all queuing up to see that.
That'll get us all back to the cinema. Actually, I was talking to my son yesterday. He'd been back to the cinema with his wife to see, was it Tenet? You know, the one that everybody's talking about.
Oh, well, yeah.
Well, the people who go to the cinema are talking about it anyway. And he gone to a flash new, there's new cinema in Islington where they live. And you know, obviously you get drinks and obviously you get a nice seat, but now you get food and so forth, you know, and they're very keen to sell you up on all this stuff. I said, so how much did this cost?
Oh, I know.
He said, I thought it was kind of reasonable.
Don't tell me, because in fact, it's just a standard ticket in somewhere, kind of even not very nice, is about 14 quid, isn't it? But a standard ticket is that we got the Barnes Olympic round the corner from us, you know, the old studio, the old Rolling Stones, you know, you get your double seats, your kind of bonkettes with your drinks delivered and all that. And that is massively pricey. So go on, I'm saying it's got to be near the 20 mark.
Well, no, they paid. Now, they had drinks and some food, okay, and they saw the film. £40 each.
Jesus.
For God's sake. That's a night in the pictures. But, you
that's
know.
It's a film that's not even seen real people on stage. It's not even theatre. That's incredible.
It's quite interesting. I've been following on social media that the fallout of people who've been to see this film, which seems to fall in one of two camps. They're either going to say, I didn't understand a word of it and it was shit. Or I didn't understand a word of it, and it was brilliant.
Absolutely.
It entirely depends on your disposition to think that kind of thing.
You've still had your money's worth. Come out
anyway,
baffled.
So that's the cinema in the year 2020 and beyond.
Yeah.
Probably, if it exists.
So look, the year 1975.
1975.
The release Funny of Born to Run.
I thought you were going to say the relief of Mafeking.
The relief of Mafeking.
Yes, no. So how many years ago are we talking?
45 years ago. Is that right? Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yes, it is. It's 45 years ago. So if we do the usual calculation, if we remove 45 years from 1975, that takes us to the year 1920. Yes.
My God.
Is that right?
Yeah.
No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. I've got that wrong. This is the year 1930. What am I talking about? This is the year 1930. So, you know, recording is kind of in its infancy. It's an extraordinary thing, really. One thing that struck me was that you could play Born to Run, you know, the track Born to Run, alongside a record made nowadays, and it wouldn't sound madly old-fashioned, would it? Whereas if you took a record from 1930, and played it alongside Born to Run, they would have sounded as if they came from different civilizations, wouldn't they, really?
Completely. You know,
the technology had kind of moved on so much. No, but it's...
almost a Dixieland jazz band you would have been listening to.
The thing that still strikes me about Born to Run, holds up copy of Born to Run for people who are actually watching this, and I can still never get over this, is that... you know, he arranged to have the pictures taken by, what's he called, Eric Miel, or yes, I think it's Eric Miel, is a New Jersey photographer. And he just turned up to do the session with him, guitar, and Clarence. You know, nobody else in the band, not the rest of the band, they didn't know about it at all.
No, it's an incredible statement, isn't it?
That's what you call a ballsy move.
Yeah. He had just decided to get across the fact that he was the leader of the group as well, wasn't he? You know, but it was the idea that the brotherhood was summed up by the two of them, and it didn't need anybody else to get that.
Yeah, place. And also it's a kind of you're clearly if you're having that kind of setup, you're clearly kind of keying into lots of aspects of American musical history, aren't you? You know, and the kind of soul band and Stax and the Review and all those kind of things. It's a very different kind of image. But the interesting thing is that he'd made Born to Run, the track Born to Run, he'd made nearly a year earlier. And when he was, you know, he was living on his own in this quite shabby little house on the Jersey Shore. I don't know if this is just one of those things that he made up afterwards because it sounds great, but it's nonetheless interesting because it illuminates his thinking. Was that he used to go to sleep every night. He had a little record player next to his bed, and he would go to sleep every night with the Ronettes or the Roy Orbison or
Duane. That's right. He says that in his autobiography, doesn't he? He goes there because he wants to absorb these records so that somehow they'll be in his DNA and he will write songs.
It's like sleep learning, you know. I think that was the idea. You know, that I'll wake up in the morning and I'll be able to do that.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because he'd made his two previous records, you know, which have flopped. They completely flopped. And this was absolute last chance, you know, the third album. And, you know, if it hadn't worked, he would have been just returned to sender. And he realized he needed a standout song, which he hadn't really had on the previous records. And so he poured everything into this song, Born to Run, which they then went and found quite a cheap studio north of New York, studio completely off the beaten track where they could afford to be for a while. And this was when he was still managed by Mike Capel, you know, the previous manager that he fell out with so badly later. And they started recording, and they did the basic track for Born to Run quite quickly. And what fascinates me about this is that if you listen to it now, it's utterly dominated by the drumming and the guitar. You know, it starts with a rumbling drum, you know.
Yeah.
Clearly going to be a record all about rhythm and all about pop music. You know, it's not going to sound anything like what he did on his previous two records. And the amazing thing to me about the drumming is that it's played by Ernest Boom Carter, who was in the band then, and that's the only thing he ever recorded with them. He left soon afterwards. He couldn't be spending months in the studio, probably had a family to feed or something like that. So the only thing that Ernest Boom Carter ever recorded with the E Street Band
was that one track.
And he then spent...
If you're going to pick one, that's the one. Pretty good one to pick.
But the interesting thing is, and this is Bruce Springsteen's kind of terrible problem, is he then spent 6 months doing everything in his power to kind of ruin it by just putting more and more and more stuff on it.
It did take that long to make, didn't it?
He spent 6 months just playing with these tracks. And to the extent that Steve Van Zandt, because the... you know, the signature guitar thing, dun dun dun, you know, which is rings out still today. Steve Van Zandt had to say to him, "You've put so many instruments on this, people can't hear that guitar anymore. They can't hear it in the way that you think they can hear it, because you're hearing it from the point of view of somebody who knows they put it on there, whereas somebody coming to it fresh can't hear it anymore." And he had to kind of record it again, you know. That guitar line, and so he was completely losing sight of when to stop, which has always been his problem, you know. And so the record itself, the full album, didn't come out until pretty much a year later, as you said, you know, sort of August 1975, and it saved him. I mean, it wasn't an enormous hit or anything like that, but it did enough for CBS, for Columbia, to want to, you know, continue with him. And by then he was getting a big enough reputation live. But what's fascinating to me is that I think it's really, this is to be brutal. You know, if you line up all the greats alongside each other, you know, Elvis Presley and the Beatles and God knows who. Born to Run, the single, is Bruce Springsteen's only great record. It's an absolutely brilliant record. It's inimitable. It's bottled lightning.
What makes that so brilliant then?
Well, I think great records are moments in time. You know, they're just instants. They're lightning in a bottle. You know, you just can't do them again the following day or anything like that. And even he... You know, and he's played it through the years, probably plays it to this day when he goes back on stage. And he'll do a very damn good job of it, but it won't be that. it won't be that thing. You know what I mean? And all the, you know, all the great geniuses of popular music, Smokey Robinson or whatever, how many great, great records? It's a small number, really, when you drill down. You know, there aren't many people who do more than five. Yeah? And so,
yeah, absolutely.
And so, you know, you say there's loads of really good records by Bruce Springsteen. I don't know, there's Dancing in the Dark, there's Hungry Heart, there's all those things. But they're not absolutely as exceptional.
Perfect,
exactly. That is absolutely
But it's interesting that such an exceptional record would be the one that he laboured over for so long, because usually that's completely at odds with the way things work. It's the spontaneity. It's the little bit of magic that you capture in 3 or 4 minutes that can't be repeated, that usually
I think is the enduring thing. Yeah, well, and I think a lot of that is Ernest Boone Carter. You know, it's what he played in that first session in 1974 is still what thrills us today. But, you know, 45 years later, that's a long old time, that is.
The Word Podcast, prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
So welcome back, viewers and listeners, to Dave and I, joined, in fact, now by our producer, Magic Alex. We're going to talk about the concept of landfill indie. Landfill indie being a phrase invented by Andrew Harrison of the Word magazine Parish in 2008. And as you rightly pointed out the other day, Dave, Andrew Harrison also invented the term Britpop.
That's very good work.
And Landfill Indie, this is a very, very spirited piece by Vice in defence of the fact that people routinely take the piss out of the whole concept of indie generally, you know.
I do.
Yeah. And this is, you know, these are groups. This is the Rifles, the Guillemots, you know, the Pigeon Detectives, Futureheads, Baby Shambles, the Kooks, the Maccabees, etc., the Fratellis. And I thought of it broadly as kind of as four chord rotations, unpolished guitars, bit of pop sensibility, enough to get on the radio, etc., etc. And the point about this piece of many is that it says that basically, after the success of the Strokes, the Bloc Party, and the Libertines, A&R charged out across the country, signed anything remotely landfill indie. As they put it, white boys with weak jawlines playing in bands with names like problematic flavours of Walker's Sensations, e.g. the Bombay Bicycle Club, Cajun Dance Party, etc. So the whole world is full of, as they put it, trilby-doff men singing about local boozers, university girlfriends in World War II. But they reckon this spoke to something uniquely pedestrian about the British experience that made it eternally irrelevant. And I think that's a really good point, because I think of landfill indie as being part of a noble tradition about suburbia and about fallibility and about general uselessness of British people, that, you know, started off with, you know, the Kinks, and then there was Penny Lane, and then the Squeeze, and the Jam, the Pet Shop Boys, Blur, Pulp, etc., the Streets. So I think it's a fantastically noble tradition and uniquely British. But we ought to ask Magic, I mean, you know, now you're here, landfill indie, well, how would you define the difference between landfill indie and your normal indie?
I think the difference is just perspective. It's not anything material, for sure. I mean, I was growing up when the landfill indie period was at its peak, and for better or worse.
And so proud.
This is your music, dear boy.
Yeah, you know, to people.
And why shouldn't you feel fond of it? Of course you did. This is the soundtrack to your exciting teenage life.
Well, the thing was, these people weren't singing about girls and boys. They were singing about what was happening to everyone at the time in the country. You know, they were singing about their life, their normal lives. There's things which you would be talking about with your friends in a pub. And it was eminently relatable. And it felt like they were talking about you, and they were talking about something that was dear and relevant to you, and somehow making it sound really romantic. And it was, and the way they were doing it was quite aspirational, you know. I think it's easy to deride people like Pete Doherty because of their personal lives, but, you know, that boy could write. He can write words. And the way he put things, the way he romanticised the very dullest elements of British life around that time was pretty aspirational. And it also made you feel like you were part of something. It gave you a sense of community, which I think all great pop music does, at least in this country, you know. It was a really good time, and I think it's easy to look back and see it also for what it was, which is derivative and unoriginal, and maybe watered down. But if you were living through it at the time, and if you were of a certain age, it was so exciting. When Preston and the Ordinary Boys released their first album, I grew up listening to The Jam, you know, when I was very young. And it suddenly felt like we got our own Paul Weller, and he passed down the baton upon a cliff face, and it was on fire. You know,
it was so that's brilliant. But why is it so unkind? Because even Vice, who love it, talk about landfill as being the family. It's like a family caravan holiday in August. Kind of rubbish, kind of a laugh, but largely unremarkable. It's unfair, isn't it? Because, I mean, there were lots of movements that didn't have any particularly distinguished groups, but they're still fondly remembered.
Are there any movements that didn't have any particularly distinguished groups? Because usually there are, aren't they? I mean, because everything, you know,
I don't mean many. I mean, only had a few.
I think that applies to everything. You know, that if you get a Merseybeat or psychedelia or whatever, punk rock.
Yeah.
There's two or three outstanding, and then there's landfill as far as the eye can see.
Yeah,
that's
there is.
The way things work.
Well, exactly. You said that about psychedelia.
Landfill Indie is the only movement I know, if it's a movement, I know that is kind of proudly known by part of its name is we're all rubbish. You know, landfill Indie.
There's too many of us.
There's too many of us. Yeah. We're all kind of indistinguishable. And, you know, who are the Beatles of Landfill Indie? Go on.
Is that the Maccabees?
No, they brought the Libertines, I would imagine.
Oh, right, good, very good, yes.
Every single subculture, when you get something that's really, really important and really all-pervading, it does get diluted by bands that aren't very good.
It's a fact of life. But the best ones are exceptional, and the best ones survive. All of those movements, they happened again and again and again. But this, I'm trying to get an idea of who the big names are from this era, because you say the Libertines, they wouldn't be known to most people, whereas the big acts of kind of, I don't know, punk rock, the Sex Pistols and the Clash, are known to people. They entered the mainstream. Go on.
The interesting thing about Landfill Indie is a lot of those bands are bigger today than they were back then. So you've got bands like Milburn, who are part of the Sheffield set, Forever in the Shadow of the Arctic Monkeys, as you know, as it mentions in the piece, you know, A&R were rushing out to provincial towns to sign whoever, you know.
Always the case, though. Whatever big boom, it always happens, doesn't it? And you always get far too many people who just aren't that distinguished.
And Milburn were one of those bands that were forever cursed by that, you know. And they reformed, I believe, a few years ago. And now they're, well, before COVID, they were selling out arenas.
Really? Wow.
Now, this is going to move seamlessly on to a related topic, which is one of my favourites, which I don't think we've aired on this podcast. And I'd like to know if you two agree with me. I think in popular music nowadays, everybody's bigger years after the event than they are at the time of the event.
Yes.
But that's absolutely, that's always true, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it hasn't always been true. It wasn't true in the 70s.
Well, no, because if you think of somebody like, the Jam kind of knocked it on the head. And, was it Wembley Arena they were playing? I think it was Wembley Arena around there.
Something
was it
like, bigger than whatever, that? Yeah.
But if they came back 30 years later or whatever, they'd be playing a massive stadium circuit, wouldn't they? Because there's been 30 years.
Because
all the people who liked them originally will go and see them anyway. But they've had 30 years.
And there's a far the greatest constituency for popular music nowadays is people who missed it the first time around.
Yeah.
Whenever the first time around was, doesn't matter. Whether the first time around was 1965, 1985, 2005, doesn't matter. Because it takes that long for word to get out to everybody. And then everybody eventually wants to tick off. I've been to see so-and-so, the Stone Roses. I've been to see the Rolling Stones. I've been to see absolutely everybody. And that's what happens. And it's a really curious thing, which is why nobody ever breaks up, or if they break up, they reform. Because there's a market for them, which is bigger than the market was there at the time when they were kind of young and inspired. Isn't that true, Alex?
Yeah, it's bizarre. I mean, the Libertines are a great example because they're bigger now than they ever were first time around. You know,
yeah.
The first time around, they might have been really influential, which they were, you know, but they were influential within the context of a subculture and not a whole generation of music lovers. Now they're, you know, I remember their management was told that their Hyde Park gig, I think 6 years ago now, was madness because they'd never do it. And they sold out all their tickets within 6 minutes or something like that. This is a band that had last broken up, I think, 5 years before.
It's absolutely extraordinary, isn't it? Because you used to think that the standard pop trajectory was, you know, 2 or 3 years hot, and then slowly nobody's interested in you anymore, you know. It's not like that anymore, you know. It's 2 or 3 years hot, dips a bit, then it goes, ooh, it just grows over a long period of time.
Which is why it's unimaginable that the groups who haven't got back together won't eventually get back together, don't you think?
Because they've all got really strong personal reasons as to why they won't.
But the amount of money involved and the feeling that you would go to your grave without ever feeling what that was like to go back and play on the stage.
That's true.
You've got to admit, I mean, Paul Weller, you know, David Byrne, these various people, Morrissey, you know, are they really, at the back of their minds must be thinking, I would wonder what it would be like.
Yeah, but I suppose it just shows in those small number of cases of holdouts who are not doing it, there's a lot of bitterness there, isn't there?
Oh, yeah, there is.
There must be. You know, whereas everybody else
you can calibrate how much that bitterness must be.
Yes,
if they're turning down $70 million,
it's $20 million worth of bitterness.
Exactly,
it's as simple as that. Okay. Yeah. Now, the other hot ancient music business story just recently, Elton John gave this interview. Go on, tell us about that.
Well, Elton John was talking about Father John Misty and Conan Gray. And he, particularly Conan Gray, he said, Conan Gray, he's from America and he's the only person in the American Spotify top 50 to actually write a song without anybody else.
Really, one
person. This is what he's claiming. And, you know, he says, Elton says that these days every song has about 4 or 5 writers on a track. And he said, you look at most records in the charts, they're not real songs. I mean, there is true. I mean, there was a Liam Payne song called Strip That Down, which I think includes 15 credits. Now, some of those obviously for maybe for samples or whatever, but 15 writers were involved in it. So 15 people are getting money when that thing was a hit, you know. And I could see his point. I mean, he wrote with Bernie Taupin, you know, and still does. But, you know, that the idea that it needs a factory of people to produce top lines, melodies, you know, structures, rhythms, find samples and things, must be disheartening for somebody who started out in an era when it was just a couple of people with a typewriter and a piano.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is reflecting a mode of writing that's written about really well in this book, which I was just digging out today, The Song Machine Inside the Hit Factory, John Seabrook's book.
Oh, it's fantastic. We did a thing about that, didn't we? Yeah,
fantastic book. Have you read that, Alex?
Sorry, guys, I muted myself.
You what?
I muted myself. I put myself back in the corner.
Oh, right. Oh, right. Okay.
Well, we might
have you read The Hit Factory by John Seabrook? It's an amazing book.
It's all about, you know, the Backstreet Boys and Max Martin and Britney Spears and that whole way of writing hits, of generating hits, that they'd done in this kind of almost industrial way, which he describes as the track and hook system. So somebody does the track, somebody else does the hook, somebody else does the top line, and you just add layers all the time. And that is how the overwhelming majority of records in the pop chart nowadays are done. I was just looking at the chart this morning, and that out of the top 10, I think 6 are credited to so-and-so featuring so-and-so. And that's just the performers. And so in each case there's a writing credit attached to it. Go on, Alex.
I'll tell you actually that so in my CD double life, I dabble in the murky world of music licensing. And I recently had to clear a track, a sample on a track, which contained no less than 19 writers.
On the sample?
Yeah, it was a nightmare.
So there was a track, and then the track included the sample, and the sample had 19
writers. So can we ask what percent, you're talking about 0.001% of the profit or something would go to somebody who's one of the 19 people on a sample? I mean, is it, that's astonishing.
It's bonkers. I mean, the percentages were all slightly different. So one party got slightly more than the rest, for example. But
yeah.
And also the sample contained a sample, which
God, this is just a
so if you put all that together, starting with the original track, your sample, and then the sample that contained a sample, is it possible? I'm just guessing here. That the total number of people who might have some kind of claim on that whole thing might be as many as 30.
Yeah, it's absolutely mental. I mean, can you imagine a world where eventually, you know, in your standard cafe, you've got 20 people making the tea? Do you know what I mean? One person for the tea bag, one person to hold the mug. You wouldn't do that, would you? Why would you do that with a song? It just completely blows my mind, but it happens. And it's
except... Now, in its defence, and I think Elton's got a fair point, but it's a reflection of just how differently records are made nowadays. But in the defence of that system, for years, I've been saying, and Mark and I have been saying on this podcast, that how come Lou Reed is the author of Walk on the Wild Side? Why isn't Herbie Flowers the co-author of Walk on the Wild Side? Why aren't the girls who sang do-de-do-de-do, you know, whatever, because they contributed as much to that as
well, there was, famously, there was a court case with Herbie Flowers, wasn't there, which was, Herbie Flowers did actually get a percentage, I think.
No, he never got a percentage.
Did he not? I thought he did. I thought it was a court case.
I wouldn't have thought so. There's a
difference between interpreting a part and composing one.
It's
a bit of a grey area, but
what we're moving towards, it seems to me, those credits that Elton is complaining about, they're not for writing a song, they're for making a record, really. Because, you know, they're all contributing their little bit, which is sent down the line as a sound file. It's not written down as a piece of music. And so the tradition that Elton came from was Tim Panelli, was two people in a room with a piano.
Yeah, completely. Yeah.
That was the way they did it. We now move to something completely different. And so you could argue that your 19 credits are genuinely reflecting what people did to play some part in it, but it's not standard songwriting as we would traditionally have known it.
Well, I think the mode of writing's changed. You know, people are writing using software like Logic and Pro Tools, and, you know, whereas, you know, in the Tim Panelli days and way beyond, you'd have a person, two people in a room with an instrument, and you'd get the body of a song, and the song would be a form rather than a very specific set of parts. And I think the nature of writing has changed to the point where the song is a specific set of parts. I mean,
you now sublet each of those jobs to somebody responsible for those specific parts, don't you?
Yeah.
So you get a melody expert to write the melody, top line. You get somebody, a chord expert, to produce a structure. You get somebody producing a particular rhythm. And you just sublet that, don't you? You say, right, I want something on here that'll work.
Yeah.
So you're getting in experts in every single discipline, which is a weird way of working. But it's, you know, that's the pressure of trying to have a commercial success.
It is. It's immensely competitive.
I suppose it opens it up because, you know, it kind of makes sense in a way. Because in the old world, for example, you know, the writer of the song would get his band in a room and he'd say, here are the chords and interpret this and whatever went around it. You know, you could say that the bass line of This Charming Man is absolutely integral to the...
it is.
You know, absolutely. But of course, Andy Rourke didn't get paid as a writer for that. He got plonked in a room with Morrissey and Marr and got told to play something to these chords. But now you get the bass player playing something to these chords and being acknowledged for it in a way that perhaps they weren't previously. So, you know.
Well, that's my point. You know, it may be a fairer split.
Yeah.
These ludicrous divisions may be a fairer split than what was, you know, the split in the past. So, you know, that's... that's a rare case of me being in defence of modern practice.
What's happened to us? I thought we were grumpy old men. It's because we've got a youngster on board. Yeah, we're in our best behaviour.
The Word Podcast, one of the few things you really need in life.
So there was a piece in Vulture the New York Magazine about music that has been requested by Trump, or used by Trump, actually, without permission, various campaigns and rallies, and about the various musicians who have objected to the fact that their music's being used. And I've just scribbled down a few of the names. Tom Petty, I Went Back Down. Panic at the Disco, High Hopes. Neil Young's Rockin' the Free World. There's a Rihanna song, I can't remember which one now. Elton John's Rocket Man and Tiny Dancer. R.E.M. It's the End of the World. Stones, You Can Always Get What You Want. Guns N' Roses, Sweet Child of Mine. Pharrell Williams, Happy. We Are the Champions by Queen. There's millions of them. All Right Now by Free. George Harrison's Here Comes the Sun. Prince, you know, Purple Rain, etc. I think it's a really interesting story. And I kind of feel a bit sorry for these guys, actually. I know it's really good publicity. If you're an obviously well-known...
It's not really good publicity.
If you're a left-wing group, you know, like R.E.M. and Neil Young, then you wouldn't imagine that, in some respects, that people would expect you to vote any other way. But you've got to feel for mainstream acts like Queen or Rihanna or whatever, who clearly have Republican voters buying their records. And so it's kind of miserable to be forced out of the closet and to have to make a public statement about what your political allegiance is. Don't you think? I mean, I feel a lot of sympathy for them.
Oh, absolutely. It must be. It's wretched. And it's interesting. In America, they've objected strenuously through lawyers and all the normal channels, whatever. But as far as I can work out, it doesn't make any difference at all, because I think the law in America is different. It's a public building. You know, these things take place. If you're on the broadcast television, is a different thing. But if you're in a public building, you can play any piece of music you like.
Yeah.
Whereas in Britain, I think you have to be permitted to play those particular tunes. But in America, they've objected, until they're blue in the mouth. It hasn't made any difference at all. And
so you can still carry on using that.
It's quite interesting what it illuminates about Trump's modus operandi, which is you do anything once, and, you know, if people object and you can't do it again, well, all right, you just do something different. You know what I mean?
But you can do it once, that's true. Until somebody complains, you can do it.
You keep on doing it, because what are they going to do? Donald Trump, throughout his entire career, has worked on the basis of sue me. You know? And in the end, most people don't, because it costs them too much money and it's too time consuming. And by the time it gets to court, everybody's forgotten about what it was there in the first place. And if you don't mind being really unpopular with those people, it's not a problem at all.
And he
doesn't mind. Because here's the point. As somebody said recently on social media, what's the name? I can't remember. The Russian former chess player is now a very trenchant pundit on matches
Spassky.
Like this. No, not Spassky. No.
I know the guy. Yeah.
He says, causing offense is the point.
Yeah.
And that's why Trump does what he does. If he wants to cause offense with those people who are over there who appear to be rich and powerful and entitled and so forth, that's great. I don't have a problem with that at all. I don't want them on my side, because my people feel good about the fact that I offend those people over
completely.
There.
Completely. So it's confirming what his people think. He just loves seeing
those people I offend, the better it is for
And
me.
The more they complain about it, the more inept and inconsequential and pointless that complaining seems, because, you know, obviously the left wing complain volubly about absolutely everything. But does it ever seem to change anything is the problem, isn't it?
Well, it's all good for him.
Yeah.
It works for him far better than it works for them. That's the terrible irony of it, you know. So anyway.
Whose music has been
enough
approved?
Enough of Donald Trump, I can't bear.
Whose music has been approved by Trump, apart from Twisted Sister? Twisted Sister.
Was that approved?
Yeah, I think it was. There was a song called We're Not Going to Take It by Twisted Sister. I think they said it was okay for him to use them.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, the interesting thing is he doesn't seem to want to use any of the music. Not that I think he has much to do with this. I'm sure it's just somebody in his team. He doesn't seem to want to use the music of the very small number of musicians who appear to support him. Like, what do you call him?
Ted Nugent.
Ted Nugent. Oh, God. I've gone blank. Ted Nugent, two or three others.
And that's it.
And that's it. Yeah. He's not bothered about using their music at all. Whereas, you know, they're using the music of people who don't apparently approve of him. That's absolutely fine.
Yeah.
So, I tell you what, very special day today. I was talking to a mutual friend recently on one of these, on WhatsApp or whatever, and she said, when did you last see Mark? And I said, well, I was thinking it must be the other day. And then I worked it out. No, it's 6 months ago.
No, it's March.
Since you, all right, so it's five
March,
months.
I think it was March the 9th when we interviewed Pete Perfidis.
Pete Perfidis and Dan
That's
Franklin.
A long time.
It? It seems an awful long time
ago. I know.
So that's the last time we were in the same physical space. And today we're meeting at a friend's, aren't we?
We are.
Socially distanced in a garden.
Yeah.
And I've got a question to ask you about your sartorial arrangements, because the weather's changed a bit now. Are you wearing shorts or long trousers?
I am not wearing shorts today, I have to say. And I don't imagine you are too, Adam, because the temperature has dropped.
It's plummeted. And on Friday, I tweeted, the shorts are going off all over the UK.
There was quite a lot of resistance to that notion.
Yeah,
I've been in shorts since March and I'm sticking with it. I'm going to go right through till the end of October. Because it's very hard to take them off if you haven't been required to go to any business meetings or anything, which most of us haven't. No. I've been living in shorts for God knows how long.
Absolutely, absolutely. And people really take umbrage, don't they? Idea that you might wear long trousers before November or whatever. People have just gone crazy about this, particularly people in the north of England, I note, who now take it as a kind of note of pride. You know, they accuse me of being a soft southerner because I decided to put on a pair of long trousers when it got really chilly in late August.
That's a classic hard northern attitude. Isn't it?
It is.
T-shirts in November, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Packet of embassy twisted into the sleeve.
Yeah. And it made me think again of one of my favourite short subjects in pop, shorts in pop music.
Shorts in pop music.
Short music, because as we've said before, our fathers, although your dad probably was a big shorts wearer, because he was a big kind of outdoors man, wasn't he?
He was.
He liked
big camping holiday man.
Camping holidays in places where the temperature rather plummeted. My dad not so much like that. I don't think my dad even owned a pair of shorts. And in that, he was not unique back in the 50s and 60s.
You tweeted a photograph of your grandparents, I think, on a beach holiday, where they're literally wearing, I think your grandfather's wearing kind of, I may even have a waistcoat on, but he's certainly got a tie and a shirt.
My maternal grandfather, Leonard Rollinson, I have a photograph of him taken on the beach of Bridlington, I think, and he's sitting in a deck chair, and he's wearing, a pair of stout brogues, argyle socks, a three-piece suit with a waistcoat properly buttoned, a shirt with a stiff collar.
Stiff collar.
And handkerchief a tie, in his top and pocket. And a tie, possibly even a tie pin in the tie.
Yeah.
Handkerchief in his top pocket. Over this is a coat and a flat cap. That's on the beach.
Yeah, that's how he tanned. so straight off to the rock pools for him. that's incredible, isn't it?
That's the Yorkshireman.
I know. No, my pa used to wear shorts, absolutely. But then again, southerners, we're from Hampshire. But in pop music, Andrew Ridgeley, a classic, obviously.
Yes.
Yeah. Angus Young, obviously for cartoonish theatrical reasons. Big shorts, man.
Yeah.
Dennis Wilson, off duty, certainly. Maybe he wore shorts on stage.
Dennis Wilson, I think, used to wear the shorts on stage quite a lot to drum because it made sense, actually.
It would have done.
I mean, who are the other shorts wearers?
Well, Pearl Jam, I think. I think there was certainly some kind of grunge groups. I'm pretty sure Mudhoney, I have a mental image of Mudhoney with kind of knee-length shorts with big pockets all over them.
Right.
Carter. In terms of the Carter the Unstoppable.
Oh, yes, of course. Those
were
kind of
major shorts wearers.
Yeah.
Axl Rose, obviously. But the one I think that gets forgotten and deserves mention in this context is the great Bob Weir.
Oh, of
Bob
course.
Weir, the Grateful Dead. Bob Weir, the Grateful Dead, who was absolutely their poster boy, and not much competition for that slot, really. No disrespect to the rest of the group. I don't think Phil Lesh was giving him a run. I don't think Pigpen was giving him a big run for his money. Certainly Uncle Jerry wasn't there. No oil painting. But I mean, he was the complete package, wasn't he? And he used to go and used to wear very, very short shorts. This is the days before knee-length shorts. Incredibly short shorts.
He did.
As Robert Plant often
wore. With his hair in a ponytail.
Hair in a ponytail.
He didn't wear shorts on stage.
No, not on stage, but, you know, famously.
You used to see them. You used to see those pictures, hilarious pictures of British rock stars in the 70s. Would get involved in pickup games of football.
That's right.
In parks in Los Angeles towards the end of tours. And then they would wear the most abbreviated shorts you have ever seen in your life. There are pictures of Rod Stewart and Robert Plant on that football pitch, and they're barely wearing anything.
They look like they're wearing underpants, don't they? Yes. They're absolutely hysterical.
They're the snugger form, budgie smugglers, you know. They're effectively playing football in budgie smugglers.
They are.
So listen, if you want to add to our list of shorts wearers in pop, we're always interested in hearing from people. You know, all feedback is gratefully received. And this is the point in the podcast where I promote the virtues of being one of our Patreon supporters who are legion and growing. And there are various benefits from being a Patreon supporter. If you delight in looking at Mark and me doing this rather than just listening to us, you can do this.
Who wouldn't? And we should mention we have two new annual books.
There's an annual patron supporter with a 15% discount, I understand.
That's right. So we should mention we've got Samantha Veal. Bless her. Samantha Veal and also Richard Lewison our annual patron supporters. And we've also got other patrons. We are Belinda Shaw, brilliant to have her aboard, and Callum McBeath and James. And Kiel Ringstrand and Clive Morrell. So that's good.
Well, we're looking forward to hearing more from those people and probably them joining us on our Friday evening Patreon supporters only quiz, which is, you know, goes from strength to strength. And also, you can, as a Patreon supporter, be in the room when we do our Word in Your Ear recordings with authors. And we recently did one of those with Kenneth Womack. Talking about John Lennon. We're doing one next week with Justin Quirk, talking about his book about the glorious rise of glam metal.
Yep.
And we got more of these coming up in the next few weeks. And you can also subscribe in euros and US dollars if you're so minded. So come on down. We'd love to have you join
us.
Cheers.
Brilliant.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.